This episode is brought to you by Dietz and Watson.
Molly, it's time we have the talk about hot dogs.
Okay. Well, hey, I'm looking for a hot dog that's the real deal, Matthew.
Like a classic hot dog that, like, when you think of, like, the platonic ideal of a hot dog, I recommend Dietz and Watson's Dietz dogs.
Ah, well, I've heard that they're handcrafted and made using only Dietz and Watson premium meat.
I can vouch for this because Dietz and Watson sent us a big box of hot dogs and other delights, and wife of the show, Lori, and I had them for dinner last night. We had the classic beef Dietz dogs with toasted buns with sauerkraut and pickled jalapenos and Dietz and Watson ballpark-style yellow mustard.
Do you think you'd recommend Dietz and Watson hot dogs for fried rice?
Oh, yeah. Fried rice with some sliced hot dogs. I'm going to be doing that soon. Wife of the show, Lori, is going to be making the hot dog flour buns from Christina Cho's cookbook, Mooncakes and Milk Bread. Very excited for this.
And I'm especially pleased because Dietz and Watson does things the right way. So this means, like, no additives, no fillers, no artificial flavors, no cutting corners. You can feel good about this stuff.
Dietz and Watson. It's a family thing since 1939.
Shop now at dietzandwatson.com/the right way.
That's Dietz, D-I-E-T-Z, and watson.com/the right way.
I'm Molly.
And I'm Matthew.
And this is Spilled Milk, the show where we cook something delicious, eat it all, and you can't have any.
And today, maybe you've guessed already, we're talking about olives.
Yes, we're talking about olives. Once again, we are coming to you from, well, here we are in my closet and Matthew's
here we are in Molly's
dining
closet.
Room.
Yeah, I can't wait till we can get back to recording together so that we can both just like cram into your closet.
Yeah, because that's how we used to do it. Your dining room table was in my closet.
Exactly.
So today I didn't have the small little comforter that I hung from the wall before. So okay. I just hung a coat on part of the wall.
Well, and it sounds great to me.
Anyway, and I've surrounded myself with quilts, which are good padding, you know, like.
Yeah, no, I've always said quilts are good padding. Yeah, no, I think even if you hadn't shown me, I could have heard, I can hear the contours of the coat.
Oh, good. Good. Great. That's what I'm always going for when I buy clothing, whether or not you can hear the contours of it.
If I look at the waveform as it's recording, it just looks like top coat shaped.
Oh, top coat. Top coat. Are we talking about?
As that word came out, I'm like, I don't know what that is. I know it's something you would see on like a British costume drama, but I don't know what it looks like.
Matthew, I think I might have told you this, that I decided to join this like online informal book club thing that's reading Tolstoy's War and Peace for the next 3 months.
I think you did mention that, and I was like, really?
I'm 8 days into it. Uh-huh. And so far, I'm wondering why I'm going to like this book or like
sure.
why I'm going to care about these characters. But there was a passage in the part I read last night where they were talking about great coats.
Oh,
like a great coat. All one word.
I feel like you're going to think that is a garment and then like 27 pages later, you're going to realize actually it's a kind of bird.
I think you're right. Soldiers were wearing it, so definitely
okay.
birds.
Oh, yeah, no. Birds love landing on statues and soldiers.
Yes.
I know that.
Okay, well, that is what I've learned so far from War and Peace.
Like, couldn't you, I mean, I understand the impulse to like, read a classic, but couldn't you read, like, a modern classic, like Little Fires Everywhere or The Pelican Brief or something? Those are literally...
Are those the modern classics
those
you
are
came
the
up
two,
with?
The only two books. I'm like, quick, think of books. Think of titles of books. Those were the only two.
I mean, like, I think that there are probably some people who would agree with you about the Celeste Ng book, Little uh-huh. Fires Everywhere. But The Pelican Brief, isn't that, like, John Grisham or something? Who wrote The Pelican? What is The Pelican
Brief? Oh, yes, it's absolutely John Grisham. And the movie was Julia Roberts and Denzel Washington, I think?
You know what's another
I've seen
modern,
the movie. I haven't read the book.
You know what's another classic in modern literature? The Firm. Have you heard of it? It's by John Grisham.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
That I have read.
Me too.
And saw the movie. Yeah, okay.
Back in the day.
So we're cultured. We read literature.
We are so cultured. We are up to date on our John Grisham.
Yeah.
What more does a person need to read, really? Today, we are talking about olives.
Yeah, and I think we've got like a special month going here. I don't know if all these episodes are going to air in the same month, but like I feel like we're really digging in on things that host Matthew is not a big fan of.
Wait, what else did we do? Oh, we did avocados.
We did avocados. And I think, yes. I feel like for me, avocados and olives kind of fall into the same category.
Huh. It's like you're very conditional about them. Like they're only specific places you want them.
Yes, that's part of it. And also, I mean, like they're both, I think I'm skeptical of them for the same reasons. Like they're rich. They're generally eaten at room temperature.
They each have a single pit in the middle.
They each have a single pit. I didn't even think of that.
Suspect.
Wow.
That is so suspect.
No. I think by the end of this episode, I'm going to make you hate olives. That's my goal.
We'll see. Yeah. Okay. Wait. Speaking of, were we speaking of memory lane?
No, but we can. We can begin speaking of memory lane now.
Okay, I'll lead it off. So I think that my earliest memory of olives is of being at some place where somebody had ordered a bunch of pizzas, like for like delivery pizzas, right? Like you're at a slumber party,
sure.
Or you're at camp and it's like pizza day or whatever. Inevitably, there would be a supreme pizza. That was what we called it back then. Do you remember?
Yes. Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
And that would have
I still
olives
call
it
supreme.
It. So that I think is where I first encountered olives and was like, and of course those were the sliced like canned olives, the black ones.
Yes.
And then I remember when my dad started going to Mediterranean Imports.
Oh yeah,
which
I've been to. I can't believe it's so exciting now when you mention Mediterranean Imports. I'm like, I've been to Mediterranean Imports. Like, who hasn't been to Mediterranean Imports?
Right. So anyway, Mediterranean Imports in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, was, as I recall, one of the first places where you could buy olives, like you know, out of like bins or you know, like an olive bar type situation.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. Because,
and so
like,
I remember, hold on, Matthew.
Yeah, sorry.
I remember my dad going there and coming home with olives and being so excited about these really good olives that he could get there that we couldn't get anywhere else.
I imagine him coming back dressed like Santa with a big sack full of assorted olives.
Exactly. Exactly.
And filling everyone's stockings. You didn't have stockings hung up because it wasn't Christmas time, so you just like put a bunch of olives in your sock.
Yeah, I loved it. It was a special tradition in our house. You would leave a sock hanging from your doorknob overnight, and the next morning it would be filled with olives.
That's what I would do in college when I was having a hookup.
So, wait, you would leave a sock on the doorknob.
I would leave a sock on the doorknob.
And then who would fill it with olives?
Like, do what I need. I to this day, I'm not sure. I guess my roommate, like as retaliation for like kicking him out of the room.
Olive Santa?
Yes, my roommate would turn out to be Olive Santa.
Okay. Anyway, so yeah, I think of olives, like as a kid, I thought of them as being gross, this thing that showed up on pizza, it was unwanted. And then I think of my dad being super excited about them and me still being like, this is gross. Who wants to eat this? Not me.
Yeah, I've always been pretty much fine with olives on pizza. And other than that, I thought of them as like a gross grown-up thing as a kid. And I'm realizing now that like there are a whole bunch of things that I felt that way about as a kid and then like grew to love as an adult. And then other things that just like stayed in that same category and I never grew up on.
Give me some examples of each category.
Okay, so things I hated as a kid but love now. Mushrooms, sushi.
Ah.
Those are two that come to mind.
Okay.
Things that I did not like as a kid and still don't like, avocados, olives, ketchup.
Yeah, condiments
yeah.
in general, right? Okay, but wait, what about, you know, I know that our dads shared a lot of similarities in terms of sort of like being descendants of Eastern European
yep.
extraction people. What am I trying to say?
They were extracted from an Eastern European
person.
They went in on some sort of spy mission and had to be extracted.
Yes. Anyway, did your dad like olives? Not that olives are Eastern European, but I think that my dad grew up like eating olives in like these sort of more international communities than I grew up in.
That is a really good question. I do not think of my dad as either liking or disliking olives. Like, you know, I think he loves kimchi, like smoked and pickled fish, gefilte fish, but olives, I've never seen him like get excited about olives.
Can I tell you something really odious about myself at a previous time?
Oh, I would love that.
You know, like in the low fat craze in the 90s?
Yeah.
Okay, so my mom was a personal fitness trainer and, like, you know, super into fitness. And it was, like, everywhere in the headlines then, like, you know, low-fat everything. This was the era of, like, Snackwell cookies and all that crap. I remember reading somewhere in, like, the sidebar of some magazine article that a single olive contains 2 grams of fat. And I remember I remember going home and like chiding my father for his like fattening olive habit. I cannot even believe that I was once this person. This is I'm embarrassed to admit it. I thought that this was an important way to take care of the health of my loved one was to scold him for eating olives.
Yeah, you're bad. But you've grown so much since then. The weird thing is that each olive has 2 grams of fat, and that fat is Crisco.
I wondered where Crisco came from.
Uh-huh.
Oh, and then olive oil comes from
eggplants. You take an eggplant, you squeeze it really hard in like a vise, and olive oil comes out. That's the Mediterranean diet.
Ah, that's what they mean by the Mediterranean diet.
It's like a whole fitness and diet plan where you like you get jacked by squeezing eggplants and then you do shots of the oil that comes out of the eggplant.
Yum. It's great for your skin though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my dad had such beautiful skin.
Fitness regimen. Like, I don't know where I'm going with this. I don't have like a bit, but like I've been doing on a YouTube 30 days of yoga series. And yesterday there was a lot of ab work and my abs have never been sorer than they are today.
Really?
Like I keep like moving in some direction. Like what's wrong with my entire it was the ab workout.
So are you the kind of person who, when you're sore from a workout, do you feel good? Is it like a hurt so good John Cougar Mellencamp feeling? Or are you just kind of cranky about it?
No, it's more like a sucking down chili dogs outside the Tasty Freeze kind of feeling. It's just I wanna like complain. I wanna make sure everybody knows that like how much it hurts so they know that I exercised once.
Yeah, yeah. No,
that's kind of where I'm at.
I would like our listeners to also know that last week you admitted to me that you had done aerobics one afternoon and injured your ankle.
Right, that's why I switched to yoga, because like less like feet slamming against the floor, and I'm sure my downstairs neighbors appreciate it more also. What are some other John Cougar Mellencamp lyrics I could have gone to?
Oh, God. So I'm a big fan of the whole Scarecrow album. Rain
What's
on the
on
Scarecrow,
that?
Blood on the Plow.
Oh, yeah, Blood on the Plow. Yeah.
This land makes me proud.
That's kind of how I feel in the whole core area. Like, it's like a real like Blood on the Plow situation down there.
Is your whole core like ROCK in the USA? Is it like rock, like a rock?
I mean,
rock hard?
That's where I'm trying to get with it. I think like having done this one ab workout, I'm hoping that's enough to achieve like total core domination.
How do you feel about authority? Do you fight authority and authority always wins?
Oh, God, yes. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
I used to be on a city board. That was literally our theme song.
Well, this has been our John Cougar Mellencamp episode.
Uh-huh.
Hey, I think I've told our listeners
Ain't that
this
America.
Before. But yes, yes. Did you know that I had guppies named John Cougar and Mellencamp as a child?
I remember you mentioning this. I'd forgotten it till now, though.
So there were good things about me. I wasn't just that kid who went around scolding her dad for eating olives because they were, quote unquote, fattening.
Ugh, yeah.
God, it embarrasses me to say it. It's like so
I know,
gross.
But I'm glad
but this show
that
is all
you
about
invited
therapy.
The skeleton out of your closet. What other skeletons do you have in that closet that you're in?
I'm going to have to rummage around in it and let you know. It's probably more dust bunnies than skeletons, to be honest.
Fair.
Anyway, okay.
speaking of dust bunnies, sorry, we're going to get to olives maybe eventually, but
okay.
At one point on the show, we were talking, I'm sure, about like words that you weren't sure if were like a special word that only your family said or if lots of people said it. My mom has always called dust bunnies garboons. Have you ever heard this?
I've never heard this.
I don't know if she made it up or like her parents made it up or if like other people say it.
Judy Amster, please let us know. After you listen to this episode, maybe you can, maybe text Matthew and let him know.
Maybe you can start a website. Maybe you can like add garboon to Urban Dictionary.
Oh, that sounds good. That sounds good. Okay, Matthew. So I'm going to take the lead here in getting down to business.
Please do.
Yeah, I'm a business person.
Mm-hmm. Yep. When I would take the lead in getting down to business, I'd put that sock on my doorknob. And catch olives.
Well, all right. So I want to try to sort of focus us, first of all, by saying that this is not going to be an episode.
That would be the first time.
Focusing us is something that truly cannot be done, but I keep trying. This is not going to be an episode about olive oil. This is an episode about olives, or like what we're going to talk about is table olives, as they're called in the industry.
Okay.
Table olives. Mm-hmm. First, I'm going to throw down some pure knowledge. You
okay.
ready?
Oh, by the way, the reason we're not talking about olive oil today is because we did that already on episode 262. So go get it.
Oh, I'm so glad you looked that up.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
No, I just know all of our episode numbers just off the top of the dome. Hit me. Give me a topic.
Grapes.
147.
This is absolutely wrong.
Just expired.
Okay. All right. Okay. So olives are fruits. All right. Olives are the fruits mm-hmm. of the olive tree, which is Olea europaea is the Latin name. Europaea. I'm not sure. I don't know where to put the emphasis.
Like, no one knows how to pronounce Latin names, right? Unless you've like taken Latin. And then even if you know some Latin, like there are some weird pronunciation things in Latin, like how C's are always a hard K sound, that even when you say it right, you feel like you're doing it wrong.
Anyway, so the olive tree is in the same plant family as lilacs, jasmine, uh-huh. forsythia, and ash trees.
Okay.
All right. So the olive tree is an evergreen tree or shrub, and it's native to the Mediterranean, to Asia, and to Africa. You will note that it is not native to the Americas, despite the fact that we grow a lot of them here, particularly in California.
Does that make it an invasive species?
Well, I don't know if I wrote that on the agenda, but in some of the places that it's been introduced, like particularly in parts of Australia, it does like become invasive and take over native species territory. I know. Anyway,
bad olives.
So, you know, I think we can all probably recognize the leaves of or picture the leaves of an olive tree, right? They're silvery green, kind of oblong.
Yeah.
And the trunk is always kind of gnarled and twisted and gets more gnarled the older
it is. I knew you were
going to
say gnarled. Yeah, and these are trees that can get really old, right?
Really old. We're going to be talking about that. Yes. So anyway, I thought this was really interesting. So the word olive comes from Latin, as you might expect, especially given where olive trees first, came to be in the Mediterranean, the center of the Latin ancient.
Well, I mean, it could have been Greek also.
That's true. Oh, that's true. The word oil in English is derived from the Latin for olive oil.
Oh, and I didn't know that.
Isn't that cool? And this is apparently true of multiple other languages, too, that the word oil derives specifically from the name of this oil.
So like when like olio de olivo, that means like oil.
Yeah, it seems like it does. So this fruit is a drupe.
Droop.
It's a droop, like that means like cherries, peaches, apricots. That's a fruit with a single pit or seed, right?
Yeah, the walls of the seed develop from the ovary walls of the flower. That's a droop.
Okay. Okay, cool. Apparently in wild olive trees, the skin is flesh is thinner and the olives are smaller. Whereas in like cultivated varieties,
sense.
I guess, you know, we've plumped them up.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, you know, when fruits are propagated by like birds or bears or whatever, like they're always like smaller and less fleshy. And because apparently like birds and bears, which are the two main what do you call propagators of seeds in the wild. They're just like, eh, this seems good enough.
I love it when I come upon a bear in the wild, like, you know, planting his crop for for the season. It's so cute to watch a bear use tools.
I love it when you come across a bear in the wild, because there's nothing I love more than watching you fight a bear and win every time. I don't know how you do it.
Remember when we went camping? I was so disappointed that there were no bears.
Me too.
Would have gotten to watch me fight a bear.
Yep.
But at the same time, we could have seen a bear planting his vegetable garden.
Yeah.
So that would
have
been
cool too.
You're
a real grizzly woman.
I am. Here's what I think is kind of interesting. Like, so obviously, I think we can all imagine olives are a pretty, like, old crop, right?
Yes.
So apparently fossil evidence tells us that the olive tree is somewhere between 20 and 40 million years old. Isn't it, like, really, like, I love how the older we get, the further we get back into history, the more we're okay with time spans of like 20 million years.
Yeah, fair. Like,
right?
Like, you know, where it wouldn't hold up in court is where I'm going with this. Like, if you're asked, like, you know, when did the murder take place? Well, you know, we think sometime between 1963 and next week.
Yes. Exactly. That is what it's like. And the first olive trees probably grew in an area that now corresponds to Italy and sort of the Eastern Mediterranean basin.
That seems fair.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that seems logical, given that that is also where most olives are grown now.
Yeah.
The first olives were, like, you know, cultivated for domestic use. What am I trying to say?
Sure.
Yeah.
They were domesticated?
They were domesticated about 7,000 years ago in that same part of the world. So apparently, as far back as 3,000 BC, olives were being grown commercially on the island of Crete in Greece. And olives, or olive oil, may have been the source of the tremendous wealth of the Minoan civilization on Crete. Pretty cool, huh?
That is pretty cool on the one hand. On the other hand, that means, like, there were, like, asshole olive billionaires.
Yes.
Back then, probably. Because, like, you know, 5,000 years from now, people are going to say, like, you know, back in whatever they're going to call this dumb era, like, you know, people were wealthy because they had warehouses full of, like, you know, shirts and audio equipment and toilet paper. And we're like, oh, yeah, that's really interesting.
But people used to be olive barons.
Right. Now there used to be olive barons.
Yes. Yes. Before the old railroad barons and Amazon barons.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Spanish colonists brought olives to the Americas in the mid-1500s. And initially, the trees, like, first caught on in what is now Peru, Chile, and Argentina.
Okay.
And then it actually wasn't for, like, 200 years until the mid to late 1700s that Spanish missionaries planted the first olive trees in California. So then in California, you know, it took a while for olive trees to really get going. But olive oil production started in California in the 1860s. But once again, we are not talking about olive oil, Matthew. So anyway.
So were people eating table olives at the time? Do we know?
Well. So from everything that I was learning, certainly there is some crossover between olive varieties that are used for eating and olive varieties that are used for oil. But I think that, like, most of the time, if you are an olive grower, you are either growing table olives or you're growing olives for oil. Like,
okay.
I think you're usually doing one or the other.
I'm going to go for the oil kind.
Oh, okay. I think that's, you're going to be an oil baron.
I'm going to be an oil baron.
I think that is a road to wealth that is well paved, my friend.
Yeah, I want to have the best thing about being an oil baron is, like, that probably, you know, we saw one, like, on the lawn of City Hall in Oklahoma City, right? Or the state capital that have one of those oil well things that goes up and down, and, like, no person of any, you know, mature age has ever looked at it without thinking about sex. right?
I forgot that you look at that and think about sex. I grew up looking at it.
Are you saying as if I'm the only one?
You're the only one. You know, I grew up looking at those, and I think I probably looked at those before I knew about sex. So I never never looked at them and thought about sex.
No, but then your parents gave you the talk, and you're like, oh, like the oil thing. What is that thing even called?
I think it's called an oil derrick.
Oh, that sounds right.
Is that, or an oil?
I think you're right.
Maybe. Okay.
If that's not the thing that's called an oil derrick, it should be because that seems like it should be called a derrick.
Yeah. Okay.
That was the most tautological thing I've ever said.
So I want to get into talking about how olives are harvested and like how they're brined and fermented and stuff, because I didn't know. And I think that's pretty cool. But first, Matthew,
yeah.
I want to talk about just, I'm going to turn here to the literary side of our podcast.
Oh, you, know, you learned something about olives from War and Peace.
This is our, what should this segment be called? We have a memory lane segment. We have a what have we learned segment sometimes. This is our
story hour.
All right. So
this segment will be 1 hour long.
All right. So as you may have noticed from history classes and reading many different types of books and looking at art, olive trees and olive branches have been used to symbolize things in many cultures and religions.
Mm-hmm. So okay? Just like how oil derricks have been used to symbolize things.
Yeah. Actually, do we use things to symbolize things? I think we're not really speaking English. Anyway, but so olive branches are a symbol for peace, for glory. In like early, like, early in the morning. I'm losing it, Matthew.
You know how, no. Like, I don't know if it's on the dollar or what, because like, who has a dollar anymore? But like, you know how a dove goes flying by with an olive branch
yes!
in its mouth? Is that something that's ever really happened? Because I know we've talked about this on the show. I've mentioned this many times that like, when I see a bird with a worm hanging out of its mouth, like, is like a thing I can see that makes me feel like, oh my God, everything in the world is going to be okay because like a bird is actually carrying a worm around, like in a kid's book.
That's how I feel when I see bears planting their vegetable gardens.
Exactly.
Yes. So, I'm like, I feel safe.
Yeah. So like a dove, if a dove ever flies by carrying an olive branch for real, I want to hear about it.
Okay. Anyway, so in ancient Greece, as well as other times and places, branches were frequently given as offerings to gods, and they were made into crowns for the victors of various games and races and things. I wonder if, you know, I haven't watched Ben-Hur anytime recently, but I wonder if at the end of that chariot race, if there was an olive branch crown. What do you think?
That would make sense. I mean, whenever I win a game of Sorry, I demand that my family make me an olive branch crown.
Great. All right. So there ends a story hour. That wasn't really story hour. It was more like literary symbols hour. Or
okay. Yeah.
Or cultural symbols. Iconography.
I think we should stick with story hour. I don't think anyone's going to tune in for a cultural symbols iconography hour.
Okay.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Let's talk about eating olives, okay?
Okay.
Well, here's one thing that's really cool before we get into eating olives. God, this episode is all over the place. It's a disaster. I just wanted to say that I think it's really amazing that some of the oldest olive trees in the world are still bearing fruit. Like, that just seems amazing to me. So there are...
How old are we talking?
There are many different parts of the world that claim to have the world's oldest olive trees.
And, oh, of course.
And a lot of these are not verified, okay? So I'm just going to list off some places that are, like, purported to have olive trees that are at least 1,500 to 2,000 years old, all right?
All right, that's impressive.
So Croatia, Israel, and Palestine, both territories claim to have extremely old olive trees, like as old as...
Time itself.
Of course, Crete, Malta apparently has a really old olive tree.
Oh,
anyway,
they also have an old falcon that sometimes carries an olive tree in its mouth. No, an old branch.
An olive tree in its mouth. If there goes the Maltese falcon. God, it has a strong beak.
Well, it's been trapped inside doing YouTube yoga. The Maltese falcon's been doing yoga and like blasting its core.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's talk about table olives. Let's talk about eating olives. All right. So
I don't believe you. You've told me like four times already that we're going to talk about that and it hasn't happened yet. So I'm not going to be fooled again.
So table olives are classified into three groups according to how ripe they are when they're harvested. All right. And I think you can imagine this. Have you ever in your years of being a snooty food person?
Oh, okay.
Did you ever do like olive oil tastings in which you would try like a young olive oil that would be more green and kind of peppery, slightly bitter? And then you might try an olive oil made from older, more mature, like darker kind of black or purple olives. And that would be like a rounder, more buttery flavored olive oil. Did you ever do this kind of thing?
I mean, I think we probably did this on our very own olive oil episode.
Oh, I don't know if I knew.
I mean, probably you told me at the time, but I don't think I knew what types of olives produce different boldnesses of olive oil.
You can imagine this in terms of flavor without even having to taste them. So olives that are picked when they're green, okay, these are full-size olives, but they're still unripe. So they're usually green to yellow. And they still have in them, in pretty high concentrations, this bitter chemical, phytochemical, called oleuropein. Oleuropein.
How do you think, I'm impressed.
How do you think you'd pronounce this word?
I'm not going to do it any better than you did.
Really? I think you could do better.
Oleuropein. No, I don't like that.
I think that's pretty good. Anyway, so that's those are green olives. Then we have the next category is semi-ripe olives. Those are picked at the beginning of the ripening cycle. So the color has begun to change from green to like some shades of red or brown.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm a semi-ripe olive at this point in life.
Yeah, me too. Is that what we call middle age?
Yeah.
Being a semi-ripe olive.
Mm-hmm.
Black or ripe olives are, of course, the third category. Those are picked when they're fully ripe, and they're usually purple, brown, or black. Although, I think most of the olives that we encounter that are black are artificially blackened.
Yes,
and
this
we're about
I do
to
know
get
about.
There. Okay.
So, oh wait, I added something to the agenda here because I remember it when olive bars started showing up in supermarkets, and even though I wasn't interested in like shopping at the olive bar, like once the olive bar came to my local supermarket, I knew things had gotten fancy around here. Like that was like a consistent marker of fanciness.
Yes, I agree. Okay, so let's talk about what olives are like when they first come off the tree, especially if they're green olives.
Yeah, I'm
like
so curious
olives.
About this because this is like one of these things where you have to do a bunch of stuff to it before you can eat it, right?
Yes. This is not like, picking an apple off a tree or a peach off a tree. This is like a fruit that needs to be dealt with before you can eat it. So raw olives or fresh olives are very bitter, and that's because they have high amounts of that oleuropein.
Let's call it OPP.
But it only has one P.
Doesn't matter. I don't remember what show this was. It was probably on Food Network, where someone was taking a tour, like the host of the show was taking a tour of an olive orchard, and the grower was like, I mean, obviously this was like a total setup, like you know, he wasn't really surprised, but had to act surprised. But the grower was like, hey, host of the show, why don't you try one of these fresh olives right off my tree? And the host bit into it and was like, ugh.
Yeah, yeah. So, so here's the thing. In order to be palatable, olives need to either be cured, or they need to be cured and fermented, usually. Most olives are fermented, in order to remove or convert the oleuropeine and other compounds, too, that make olives kind of yucky tasting. So generally speaking, these compounds are at really high concentrations in young olives, right? And in some cultivars of olives, as they mature on the tree, the oleuropein is converted to other, like, more palatable compounds. And those particular cultivars are sometimes edible when they're fully ripe without curing or fermenting. But I think that is not the case for most olives that we encounter.
Okay. So I'm kind of used to the idea from, like, you know, research that we've done from the show that, like, humans will, like, fuck around with any food until they find a way to eat it. Mm-hmm. How do the bears do this?
Well, I think that animals eat a lot of stuff that is not palatable to us, dude. I mean, like, my dog was eating the leg of a dead crab on the beach today.
Ew.
Yeah, I had to stop her. She's gotten food poisoning from that before.
Yeah.
But so I don't know. I mean, I wonder, you know, animals that live in places where olive trees grow, I imagine they're eating the olives off the trees,
yeah.
Right?
Well, and I think, like, that was the thing about the bears was supposed to be a joke, but now things have just gotten very serious. Because we talked about this, I think we've talked about this on like a chili episode or something, that, like, lots of like hot peppers are propagated by birds who seem to do not respond to capsaicin and just, like, don't notice that they're spicy.
That is so interesting to me.
And the capsaicin is there to ward off, like, mammals that will digest the seeds.
Okay. So the animals that would pass the seeds in their poop or whatever are the ones who would be able to eat it without experiencing the capsaicin.
Yeah. So maybe
cool.
Like, there's a similar thing going on with olives, but we can always outsmart some stupid plant.
That's true.
We humans,
true.
That is.
Well, so here is how we outsmart that plant. All
yes,
right.
Good
so,
segue.
So the curing process takes, if you're using lye to cure your olives, it takes only a few days, and some olives are cured with lye. If you're curing them in a salt brine or by salt packing them, it can take a few months. So
okay.
I didn't list it here because it was way too much detail, but there are, like, different regions. Like Spanish olives, at least according to Wikipedia, entire regions might tend to cure their olives in the same way, using the same, like, steps or whatever. Who
Where
knows?
Do you get lye?
I don't know.
There are all these, like, traditional, like food processing.
Omni.
Yeah. Like, you know, people have, like, lime and like consue water and lye. Like, where did people get this stuff?
I have, like, no idea.
Like, I would get it from, like, a hardware store, probably.
Did they get it by grinding rocks or, like, the right different concentrations of minerals from different rocks? Or I have no idea.
I think grinding rocks is the answer.
Grinding rocks. Okay. Anyway, so here's the deal. This curing does two things. What it does is, while and maybe you can help me understand here. So let's say you've got some olives that are soaking in a salt brine, okay? Well, so there's also, like, natural microflora, like yeasts and things, mm-hmm. on the skin of the olive.
Okay.
And as the olive is curing, those natural microflora on the skin of the olives also induce fermentation, okay?
Okay, that makes sense.
So this process, this curing and fermentation, it does two things. It leaches out and breaks down those phytochemicals that make olives taste bitter. And it also generates other metabolites that give table olives, like, it helps preserve them. So makes some of them, sometimes it makes them shelf stable. And it also gives them, like, the texture and the flavor that we're used to. So
that makes sense. What was I supposed to help explain?
Oh, well, how it is that, like, this curing process also induces fermentation. The microflora are present. And so is it just that while the curing is happening, the microflora are also, like, waking up and starting to do stuff?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Okay. Okay, cool. Anyway, so, you know, I was remembering as I was reading up on this that the first olives I liked, and this seems really weird to me, but the first olives I ever liked were oil-cured olives.
What does that mean?
Well, so have you ever noticed in the olive bar that there's usually one particular tray of olives that is not in a brine?
Oh.
It's usually dry, and they kind of look like raisins. They look like,
really opaque. So now that you mentioned that, yes, I don't usually spend a lot of time near the olive bar because it's full of olives. But
yeah.
But when I happen to pass by, I have noticed that.
Okay. Well, so what those are olives that are initially salt cured. They're packed in layers of salts. And so they don't actually ferment a lot. They,
okay.
They mostly just cure. And then, so those are salt packed olives, but then to make oil cured olives, they're cured in salt and then they're washed and soaked in oil. And
oh, I bet those have like 4 grams of fat per olive.
And anyway, so they almost wind up looking like a raisin, like kind of a big black raisin. Anyway,
like a date sort of.
But they're obviously much smaller than that. They're like olive size. Anyway, those were the first olives I ever liked, which seems very strange to me now because compared to olives that are packed in brine, they are really strong and really salty. Anyway, so yeah, so that is a different way of curing olives, is curing them by layering them in dry salt, not a brine.
I mean, but to be fair, as a kid, your nickname was Little Strong and Salty.
Anyway, so let's talk about the way that some olives are artificially blackened or like artificially ripened, because this is super cool. So this process was invented in California in like the mid 1890s, actually in Oakland, by this German woman who I guess was trying to figure out what to do with some olives she had growing on a tree that she wanted to make palatable. Okay.
Okay. God, so, I hope MC Hammer appears in this story.
So this is how all the olives that you, like black olives that you buy in a can, any olives that you buy that say like California ripe olives is what they're generally referred to. Anyway, they're not fermented. What you do is you start with green or semi-ripe olives, which are then soaked in lye. Here we get the lye again.
Yeah.
Then you wash them in water that is injected with compressed air. So it's like you're washing them in like fizzy water.
Oh, but air doesn't make water fizzy.
But compressed air.
Okay.
Well, so this washing of these,
like getting like power washed?
I don't know.
I bet there's a video, like a, you know, how stuff works video.
Okay. Well, anyway, so, you know, you've got these green or semi-ripe olives. They're soaked in lye. Then they're washed in water that's injected with compressed air. And this is done several times until both oxygen and lye have soaked through the olive's flesh all the way to the pit. And in the process, this oxidizes the skin and the flesh, turning it black. So this kind of mimics natural ripening, and then they're brined and sort of corrected for acidity, and they're ready to eat.
That's so weird because it's
Isn't that so weird?
You know, for thousands of years, people have been like screwing around with this fruit and like have figured out how to make it edible. And then some German lady in Oakland comes along in 1890 is like, you know, I got a different way to fuck around with this and also make it edible.
Well, and the other thing, and this I couldn't really find, is like, why didn't she just leave them on the tree and then brine them the old world way?
Well, like, this sounds faster, I guess.
I guess if you're too impatient to wait for your olives to be ripe, but you want them to look like they're ripe, you can do this.
Well, I mean, these are the cheapest olives, so there must be something about the process that's more efficient than the old school method.
Yeah.
Right?
It sounds like maybe it also happens a lot faster, right? I mean, if you're like forcing this oxygen, you know, this oxidation process. Anyway, so yeah, Matthew, so now that we have done all this talking about olives, you still don't like olives.
Right. So you asked me before this episode to think about like how I would describe the flavor and texture of an olive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I don't think it's just about the texture with olives, although I think that's a lot of it, that it's like a rich room temperature thing that's dense and has like kind of like a fudgy texture to it.
I think you're describing so many different things. Brownies.
I would prefer pound cake over
human
olives.
Flesh.
Can we pivot
it
the episode
a fudgy texture.
Right now? I don't think human flesh has a fudgy texture.
Oh, come on, man.
Oh, no.
Where's the yes you ending?
You just caught me in your trap. Like, you made me admit that I've chewed human flesh and it doesn't have a fudgy texture. Now, this is when the cuffs go on. Good thing,
okay.
Good thing you're all the way over there in your closet.
Mm-hmm.
They'll never catch me. I don't know. Like, and so then there's like a sharp, like, you know, briny funk that cuts through that, like, kind of goes up your nose when you're eating an olive. I don't know. Like, I want to like them.
Have you tried many different types of olives? You know, since the introduction of the olive bar, it is easy to get many different types with different flavors.
No, because I don't like them. But I've tried different types of olives on pizza, like our local pizza chain, Pagliacci, like they'll do a deluxe supreme pizza with California, quote, ripe olives. But they'll also do like a pizza with Kalamata olives. And I like that too. Like on a pizza, it works for me because I'm not having to face the texture head on and the flavor like gets to like kind of jump in with a bunch of other flavors.
What about green olives?
I think that would probably be my last choice. But
okay.
I don't know why. Like I couldn't tell you like, and it, you know, it's because green olives have like such and such a flavor notes.
Okay. Well,
I couldn't tell you about flavor notes.
So, you know, I think one of the first olives that I tried after I decided that I didn't hate olives was obviously the Kalamata, you know, mm-hmm. a quite ubiquitous olive. I remember when my dad was sick and a lot of different, you know, people in our community were bringing food to us, I remember this seemed like a very new combination at the time. This was 2002. Uh-huh. I remember some neighbors bringing over like a big bowl of like mesclun greens, some shaved fennel, some Kalamata olives, and like, you know, orange supremes.
And oh, we were that supposed sounds to very toss, 90s.
Right? Isn't that super
yeah.
90s? Anyway, I remember Kalamata olives were sort of the gateway olive once I had decided that I was into them. Kalamata olives,
I think that makes sense.
Also show up in Greek salads, especially here in the States. I'm not sure about Greek salads in Greece. Then
Wait, weren't
I remember,
you, weren't you in Greece?
I was in Greece, but, you know, I was just in a small part of Greece.
Okay, next time you should go to a big part of Greece
and Greece,
check out the salad situation.
And like part of what is so cool about like the Greek islands, let's just turn this into the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Part of what's so cool about the Greek islands is that
Greece has a lot of grams of fat.
Each one has a quite different food culture. So there's some, like, even though these are islands that I'm talking specifically about the Greek islands, not the mainland. So there's somewhere like seafood is really, really important. There's somewhere seafood is obviously really important, but then there are other ones that have almost sort of like an Italian kind of vibe with a lot of pasta and like chickpeas. Then there's some where like meat is much more prevalent, lamb. Anyway.
Which is the one where the Cyclops lives?
So this is
Did you
what
go
makes
to that
me,
island?
This is what makes me say that I'm not sure if there is a particular type of olive that is used in what we think of as Greek salad. But hold on, I'm not done.
Yeah, please.
So then, like, so in France, I think is for me where I first tasted a lot of like green olives, like Picholine olives, right?
Oh,
those
that's
are kind
a
of like
olive?
Yellowy
okay.
green, yeah. Or like those tiny little purpley black olives, Niçoise olives, Spanish Arbequina olives are kind of a like a purplish green, I believe, or kind of brownish. But I would say that these days the olive that everybody's really into, including my kid, is Castelvetrano olives, which
yeah,
are those
I've heard the word, but I don't know what it is. Tell me.
It's a quite bright green olive. It's very round as opposed to kind of being oblong.
Oh,
and,
okay.
The
so
one
you can
thing
like
I'd
shoot marbles with it if necessary?
Exactly. Exactly. That is actually how it rose to popularity. Is people were like, it's, you know, like marbles are really hard to find in stores these days. Kids don't seem to be playing with marbles. But if you want to play with marbles, like, it's easy. Just go to the Olive Bar.
That makes sense. Yeah, like that's why we used to shoplift from the Olive Bar, was to feed our
marbles.
so we could keep gambling on marbles. Have you ever played marbles? Like where you like draw a circle and like you got like a shooter and a, I don't remember what they're called. Marbles is not a good game. Like
my brother had a huge marble collection. I think that he used to play marbles.
Yeah, no, I had a marble collection as a kid, and then I was like, oh, let's play marbles. And it's kind of like dominoes. Like, you're like, oh, you know, it's like a fun artifact to collect and play with, but the actual game kind of sucks.
What about marble tracks or marble runs? Now, I like those.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What about the video game Marble Madness? That was good. Hard game, but good. Yeah, like marble tracks. Like the one with like the wooden one with like blocks that they would go through and then ramps. Oh,
yes.
Now we're talking.
I wonder how many hipster parents have tried sending a Castelvetrano Olive down a marble track.
Yeah, all of them.
All of them. Yeah. You know what I do here at home on Saturday nights. Yeah. I put my Castelvetrano Olive in my marble track, if you know what I mean.
I put my Castelvetrano Olive in my marble track.
Oh, yeah.
That's the end of the story.
I think one reason that people love Castelvetrano olives is that they are a quite like mild olive in terms of brininess. They're a very buttery and not too briny olive. The one thing that I don't love is that, kind of the same way that some stone fruits are freestone and some are like cling.
Oh.
I think of Castelvetrano olives as being a particularly clingy olive. Like, it's very hard to get the flesh off the pit, and that bothers me.
Like, not that I've often eaten an olive, but that sometimes I've, like, you know, there's been olives at a party or something. Like, I go to a lot of olive parties. I'm not bragging. Yeah. But, but like, you know, I'll pick it up, like, okay, like, I'll eat an olive, but then it takes a lot of, like, scraping, like, with my little mouse teeth to get to the inside of the olive.
What I love about olive parties is, God, I always love it when they have a marble track there, and then we all put our olives down the marble track, and it is hot.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And like if you win, you win big.
Yes. What does it mean to win big? Does it mean you get to take somebody else's spouse home, like a key party?
That's what I was thinking, for sure. Oh, yeah, good. It's an olive party. That's what they call key parties in Greece.
Oh, olive parties. Yeah.
Yes. I have a question. Who do you think would win in a fight between a bear and a cyclops?
Oh, I think a cyclops. Yeah, because cyclopses are bigger.
And smart. Kind of smart. I mean, like, not as smart as Odysseus, but, like, they're sort of, like, you got, like, human-ish brains, right?
I also think that they... Wait, the cyclopses, aren't they one of the sons of Cronus? Didn't he reject them or something?
Well, that's rude. Yeah, Cronus was not very nice.
He was not nice. He was not nice. That he's like the definition of not nice. Anyway, yeah, so this is our olive episode.
Yeah, so we've learned that Molly can beat a bear in hand-to-hand combat. Mm-hmm. Cronus, the Lord of the Titans, was a real jaghead. And I know that's pretty much it. That's all. That's most of what I remember. Oh, that olives can be substituted for marbles, but only certain olives.
Yes. There we go. All right.
What have we learned? That's what we learned.
That's what we learned. So anyway, I would really like to hear from Judy Amster today about that word for dust bunnies. I've already forgotten it.
Yeah. Where did it come from? Garboons.
Garboons. Okay. Mm-hmm. I would also like to hear from our listeners at facebook.com/spilledmilkpodcast. I would like us to hear, I mean, I would like them to tell us. Maybe. What do we want them to tell us?
How did you feel about listening to a show where one person was talking about olives and another person was interrupting it? and trying to think of as many John Cougar Mellencamp songs as possible.
I think that one of the weaknesses of this episode, this has turned into our this is now the what could we have done better segment.
Okay, yeah. This is going to be a new segment that's going to be happening a lot, like a real self-reflection.
I think one thing that we could have done that other listeners will maybe be able to chime in on Facebook is I think that we could have talked more about cooking with olives.
Oh,
because
there's
so many great recipes and dishes that rely Marbella upon olives.
From yes. the Silver Palette Cookbook? Is that olives? Yes.
And prunes, right? Isn't it olives and prunes? No. That sounds wrong. Well, are you looking it up?
I'm Wikipedia-ing it right now. The Silver Palette's Chicken Marbella recipe. If there's such a thing as boomer cuisine, it can be found in the prunes
harsh.
And green olives and capers. Yeah, because I was thinking, is it capers or olives? It's both and prunes. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Okay. So I'm so glad that we did wind up getting in a mention of chicken Marbella.
Yeah.
Anyway, so please, listeners, facebook.com/spilledmilkpodcast
at all. This is the, just said the word tapenade for the first time. On this
I can't
episode.
Believe
I've
we
said
didn't talk about tapenade. I love tapenade. All right. So listeners, come help us out. Tell us what you like to do with olives other than use them as marbles.
Yeah. No, that because that goes without saying. All right. So you can do that at facebook.com/spilledmilkpodcast. You can also find us on Instagram at spilledmilkpodcast and let us know there. Our producer is Abby Circatella. Please rate and review the show wherever you find it. And until next time, thank you for listening to Spilled Milk, the show that's soaked in lies.
Wow, plural. Wow, harsh. I'm Molly Weisenberg.
And I'm Matthew Amster Burton.
Hang on, I need just a second.
Yep.
I'm so sorry.
Yes? You need your sweatpants. Ash, you should have thought of that before I started taping. You're going to have to walk around with no pants.
Oh my, seriously?
No.
Oh.
Get in here and get your pants. But Matthew is on the video, so don't show him your crotch. Good Lord.
This is Matthew.
God, Matthew, look away.
Matthew.
Okay.
You turn off the camera.
Okay. No, I can't turn off the camera. Are you kidding? That's too difficult. Okay. Anyway, so...
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.